Welcome to the Teachers on Fire podcast, where I profile agents of growth and transformation in education today. Each guest shares their highs, their lows, their passions, their goals, and the resources that are shaping their thinking and inspiring their practice. For show notes and links from each episode, visit teachersonfire.net. You can also follow the show at Teachers on Fire on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And of course, please subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm your host, Tim Cavey. Let's meet today's guest. Today, I'm privileged to be speaking with Dr. Christine Younghusband. Christine is passionate about teaching and learning and the role of leadership in enhancing the student learning experience in K-12 and in higher education. She earned her doctorate in educational leadership in 2017 from Simon Fraser University and is currently an assistant professor at the University of Northern British Columbia in the Bachelor of Ed program and the Masters of Educational Leadership program. Christine remains connected to SFU as an affiliate scholar at the Center for the Study of Educational Leadership and Policy and member of the Academic Council at the Center for Imagination in Research, Culture, and Education. In addition to her work at UNBC, Christine is an independent educational consultant, sessional instructor at St. Mark's College and SFU, and co-moderator of hashtag BCEdChat on Twitter. Her 25-year career in education includes teaching secondary mathematics and science in BC public schools and contributing to the provincial math curriculum redesign. Christine is a learner first. Her teaching practice is guided by her inquiry and curiosity. She learns by doing with a willingness to try, take risks, and try again. Follow Christine on Twitter at ChristineYH, on Instagram at Christine Ho Younghusband, and on her blog at ChristineYounghusband.com. Dr. Christine, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Are you ready to talk education?
Absolutely. Let's go.
Let's go. Well, Christine, you are someone that I was privileged to meet in person last year. I sat through one of your sessions at that lovely assessment conference that we attended together in Delta. And ever since then, I've been thinking and looking forward to this conversation. So I am so excited to connect with another educator. And I have to say, listening to your resume, that's amazing that you fit all of that in. You certainly don't present as I feel like I'm older than you, but at any rate, you've got a lot of amazing experience and expertise. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit more about your current context in education? What does that look like for you on a daily basis?
So right now I live in Prince George, British Columbia, Canada. And so for listeners out there who are not from BC, it's in the central interior of British Columbia. Some people would regard it north, snowy north. And I work at the University of Northern British Columbia in the teacher education program. So Prince George is a mid-sized community, about 75,000 people. And just this week, a few days ago, it was minus 44, I heard on the news, minus 44 degrees Celsius.
Oh.
And I had snow up to my hips. And why is that relevant is because really I spent most of my life living on the coast, west coast of British Columbia, where the temperatures are wet and mild. And so it was a bit of an awakening. So, but in the end, I'm born and raised from Prince Rupert and live most of about 25 years on the Sunshine Coast, I'm really enjoying my time here in Prince George. So my current, what I currently do is work in the UNBC teacher education program and in the leadership program. I joined just last year and I serve on the Senate, and I've been part of the Bachelor of Ed and Masters of Ed redesign committees. So what I find super exciting here at the university is that, you know, not only in British Columbia did we do a redesign of the curriculum, our program wants to be responsive to that too. And so we had a chance to really reimagine what teacher education could look like. And then from that storyline, what does our Masters of Education programs look like for professionals? So I really feel privileged to be working at UNBC and continuing my career in education.
That is so exciting. I can't wait to get into what you talked about there with the program redesign, and particularly at the post-secondary level, right? Because so much of our assessment work happens in the K-12, but a question that always comes up is, well, what about university? And so we're going to get there. But first of all, it's story time. So share with us about a low moment or an experience of adversity, Christine, that you've faced somewhere in your teaching or education career, and describe how you overcame it.
Yeah, no, and honestly, I've been listening to your podcasts, and honestly, this is probably my favorite part, which is in some level kind of dark. but I really enjoy listening to people's stories, because it just tells you to be in this profession, we need to have a level of grit and resilience,
right?
To do the work that we do. So about 10 years ago, I think my lowest moment is when I left teaching. So, which is kind of ironic. And I think at that time, if I had to sort of look in my classroom, it was probably the peak of my career. I had really great students. I had established clear routines and expectations. I taught senior math. And I just felt like this is, you know, in my four walls, the best place I could be. Right. But, you know, I'll say long story made short, outside of those four walls, was challenging. And I would say disruptive, and in my mind, sort of, I would say tampered, with questions like, what do I value in my practice and in my workplace? And it became really challenging. And at that time too, and maybe it's sometimes the more that you know, it's either you realize the more that you don't know, or the more that you know, you realize you didn't really know what you saw. But I started my doctorate program at that time. And it just, you know, I had a little, I still have a daughter, but she was little at the time. And I just had to make a choice, working full time, doing doctoral work, and being a mom. And something just had to give. And I left teaching. And I felt really blessed to do that, because I just had a nice window of time with my daughter, you know, still, love walking to school with her mom. And, I just would not trade that time, at all. So, continued with my work. And so basically, you know, how I sort of overcame that is, it was, you know, my intention was leaving the practice was to finish my dissertation as soon as possible and then return into some form of education. But I find, I don't know if other educators can empathize with me, but you get a little distracted. And I had an opportunity. we were learning opportunities, if shall we say, to be part of the municipal elections and become a school trustee. Mm. And it was an interesting opportunity, because it was still in the public education system, but I'm not in the rigor of the day-to-day of the public education system as a teacher. And so, you know, ironically, I served two terms as a school trustee. And what was super amazing about it is that it gave me a different perspective about education, which helped me finish my dissertation. So even though it was a distraction, it actually was an extraordinary blessing to take a look at something that I would say love again. I would say I started to love education again. And I really feel lucky about the people I've met and the things that I've learned through my trusteeship. And so basically that's how I sort of came out of that. It's like, oh man, like this is, school's amazing. We make a difference in people's lives, and we have the power to do that. And so, and really as soon as I finished my doctorate, returned back to teaching in higher ed. And honestly, I think this is where I'm meant to be, not necessarily higher ed, but teaching and learning with others. And it's really exciting. So I'm really happy to be here. And so and in that time, I just got to do really fun things, things I didn't imagine that I would do if I was still a high school math teacher. I mean, I got to work on the First Nations Education Steering Committee Math Teacher Resource Guide. I got to work on the BC's new curriculum for math K to 9. It was K to 10, but now K to 9. I worked, you know, with the BC Math Teachers Association on their executive committee. I was a keynote on the UBC Aboriginal Math K-12 Symposium, you know, and that's just highlighting sort of the fun stuff that I got to do. And, you know, sometimes, you know, when I was in the practice, you don't know first, but the impact that you make on students and their trajectories. And I really have a greater appreciation of that now having left. And because you have those relationships with those students, and they'll tell you that you've made an impact on their lives. And the other part is I'm grateful that that education is more than just, you know, what we perceive is like teaching math. I could have taught math until I retired, right? And so you say, you know, you mentioned that, you know, like you look at my CV or my resume and it looks diverse, but really it was, every day was a struggle, but every day was a learning opportunity, and it was really, it's been exciting. So I'm really, I think in some ways, I think all of that was meant to happen.
You know, it's so interesting. I wrote in a blog post last week that we don't learn a whole lot when we're too comfortable as professionals. And I think about that period of personal adversity that you shared, and in a way it derailed your career, but you've gone on, as you just shared, to have all of these different diverse experiences that maybe might not have happened. And, you know, it's not to say that you would make that trade again, because the, you know, on the personal side, there's a lot of difficulty and challenge there, obviously, but professionally, you have such a rich, as you say, CV with all of these different, I mean, you've taught in the classroom, you've developed curriculum with the provincial government, with the Ministry of BC, you've taught at the post-secondary level, and you've been a school trustee. The only thing that I can think of that is left is administration, or have you already done that?
No. Thank you for asking.
Because you are obviously you're in a very unique position. I'm sure you're my first guest that can really make that claim. Phenomenal. So, well, thank you for sharing that journey. Christine, speaking of that, I was, again, as I said at the top, I was fortunate enough to sit in on a workshop you led last year called Formative Assessment in Teacher Education. So as I said a few moments ago, this is an area that really interests me, and I know it interests so many educators, because I get into these conversations about going gradeless and feedback model, standards-based assessment, and all of these moves away from traditional assessment, and then the question always arises, well, what about post-secondary? So let's talk about that. How would you like to see assessment models evolve at the post-secondary level in the years ahead? And how do mindsets need to shift in your mind in order for these assessment paradigms to really make the change?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We just gave a presentation yesterday. And we gave a presentation on BC's curriculum and the shifts that we're making in K-12 to faculty. And what's fascinating is that it did give, some faculty some solace that, you know, from grades 10 to 12, we still have percentages. So, I mean, I will say our steps are incremental. And I think, but I'm really... delighted to know that K-9 is, you know, moving towards gradeless. There's practitioners out there that have gone gradeless, and I think people are watching. I think that the other part is that we have so many policies and regulations out there that are all interconnected. You know, to unravel them, you have to start change from somewhere, right? And I just feel in BC, K-12 has taken the lead on that. I think that higher ed is, in my opinion, slow to adopt at this point in time, although they are really attracted to what does it mean to be a learner? I mean, that's attractive, particularly if you're in a research university. I mean, that's what we're doing, is learning and writing about it, right? And so, you know, the one thing, so I would say the transition from K-12 to university, I think that's going to take some time. There's a lot of sense making out there. I think that, you know, universities like UBC and KPU, so Kwantlen Polytechnic University, yes, two BC universities, who have really taken some strides on doing portfolio entry, which is amazing, and in a sense, gradeless. And so it's just, how do systems have to change to incorporate that kind of shift of intake? So that's one part. So I think that will take time, because when you're looking at thousands of applications, how do you vet that? So I think that's one thing. We're all about efficiencies in at some level in systems. But I can speak about for UNBC School of Education, and you know, it's really exciting as not only were we, I'll say quote unquote, approved by the BC's Teachers Council on moving forward with a redesigned program. We just yesterday at the same meeting approved within our own college that we're in support of this new change in our BC Ed program. And one of the things that we want to do in our teacher ed program, not just to, respond to K-12 education in BC in preparing pre-service teachers, is that we want to really just focus on learning. And so to do that, we really endorse the idea of having a pass-fail outcome in our program in different courses, which at this point in time, this year, we're still have grades. And so I find that having a pass-fail program, which is similar to UBC Okanagan's teacher ed program, they just went pass-fail, you can really focus on trying to meet a criteria expectation. And I think the best, and I'm going to bring this up because I think I was always fascinated by this example, and I'm kind of leaning my practice on it right now, but which is, you know, I think in the field may have mixed feelings. So when my daughter was taking swim lessons, and she's trying to, you know, going through, you know, little turtle level and whale level and, you know, salmon level, I'm not really sure what the names were. But anyway, the point is that when you read, I will say in quotations, the report cards that come from swimming lessons, it's a list of criteria or a list of competencies, a list of skills and expectations that you have to meet. Mm-hmm. And yes, it comes off as a check mark or not a check mark, which in essence is the single point rubric. But you know exactly what you need to do to pass that level, right? And so I find that interesting in my mind, is it is really in essence pass fail. And it's not black and white that you're doing it. It's that, have you reached that expectation? So my example that I always like to talk about is, can you swim 50 meters? And for a student who is, or student, I want to say swimming student, who's trying to swim 50 meters, if they can't do it, they probably stop at 37 meters. It's going to be clear evidence that they're unable to meet the 50 meters. But the next, you know, swimmer might swim and they reach the 50 meters, but I'm pretty confident they probably can swim 51 meters or 52 meters. So it's not that 50 meters is a ceiling. It's just this finite expectation. Can you reach this, right? And typically, if you can reach it, you're obviously exceeding it, right? So that's what I think is so interesting about this pass-fail concept, which, you know, grade-wise would be equivalent to a B+. But in my mind, we don't have to focus on the competition. Are you better than me? You know, sometimes I find grading, it sets a singular expectation. And so you're grading them on how well they were able to reach that expectation. When really, if we're really trying to honor, you know, say K-12, but also learners in general, personalized learning, our strengths, et cetera, we have to really acknowledge the diversity of the people that are in front of us. So what are those competencies that we're looking for from our teacher candidates, in essence, and we're defining those. And then it will be a pass-fail from that. So I'm really excited. And I've been doing that, I will say, in a pseudo way, because we're sort of, you know, it's just like, you know, you know, it's just our, I like to call this our play year to try things out. And I will say that on my course syllabus, and I'm just playing, is, I removed all the numbers off of my course syllabus. It's not to say that the numbers aren't there. They exist in another policy document, but I just didn't want to have it consuming my course syllabus. I didn't want people to say, I'm going to do this because that's worth 40%, and I'm going to do this because it's worth 20%, and this is only worth 10, so I may not do that. You know, this is not about negotiating what you will learn. All learning is good, right? And everything that we're doing is interconnected to an outcome. So it's been really fun, and I've been sort of treating it like a pass-fail, and the quality of work, honestly, that's coming from my candidates, it's outstanding. I mean, I think that they feel uneasy because it's new. And we're sort of, in a way, kind of playing a game. But I find also the students are focused. You know, it's all a kind of a game, right? I'll call it strategic learning. They're navigating.
Right.
And so now it's about building trust and relationships, et cetera. But
yeah,
really the quality of work that's coming from my students is, I will even say, exceeding my expectations, because they're not burdened by what is an A, what is a B, what is a C. So I look forward to our new program and see how it works out in a program based.
Christine, I don't know if you remember this, but I just graduated from VIU's Masters of Educational Leadership program last year. And I love telling people this. I did not see a letter grade or percentage in the entire 2 years I was in the program. And so I think our schools are really working in the same space in terms of redefining what assessment can look like at that post-secondary level. And of course, one of my instructors actually in year one was Dr. Deborah Cohen, who I believe you work with. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, people hear that and they're like shocked, you know, but it's definitely possible. And to your point, I found that, you know, in my cohort of 45, there was so much professional pride and integrity in the room that we all wanted to work our butts off. There was no sense of, oh, this is just pass fail. I can cruise through this. And, you know, I don't really need to put in the work or the rigor. I mean, I would say the opposite was the case. And of course, the feedback was there through the whole experience as well. So
I would agree. Yeah, I totally agree with you. And just to interject, I also think that formative assessment becomes more meaningful. Like,
totally.
It's, you're always pushing, you're always receiving, and there's nothing at risk except for being better, you know? And so it's pretty phenomenal. And it's fun to hear you say that in your master's program too. And because it's pass fail, you just want to do it because it's, I wouldn't say the right thing to do, but it's because you're actually wholeheartedly interested in the learning that you're engaged with, which is cool.
100%. Yeah, that's quotable. And I mean, obviously a favorite topic of mine, but you said it so well. So thank you. And that's super, super exciting to hear what's going on there. Well, thank you for that, Christine. Let's talk about your current students. Many or all of them are future teachers. And I was thinking prior to the interview, many of them likely enter your program rather disconnected from other education professionals. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. These are younger students, probably most of them younger than I am familiar with, or let's say out of my age bracket. But I wanted to ask you this. How do you make the case for them to engage online and build a professional learning network? In your experience, what makes this time well spent? How do you address that?
Yeah, so first of all, I find it interesting in British Columbia, the teacher candidates that we're intaking. I would say the age is ranging.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, and one is that the demand is high. We need teachers in BC. And I think that people are, because of that, are looking at their careers and maybe redefining and becoming teachers. So we have teacher candidates ranging probably, I'm going to say 22, might be younger. I'll say 22 because it makes me feel better about myself. But I'll say from 22 to my age, you know, and I just, sure. Which will remain nameless, but you can
sure.
Do that. Anyway, so it's really exciting how diverse the learners that are coming into our program. So I'll say that first of all. I also am a little surprised, though I kind of made some assumptions that our teacher candidates would be a little more involved in social media, even though some are, I would say the majority are not. So I find that also fascinating. And then this was my first year teaching Education 431, which you guest spoke in, and I am totally, utterly grateful for that you did that, which is my ed tech course, bringing in guest speakers because I needed to do that because that was not my field of expertise. Except for that I'm on my phone a lot, but, you know, and so one of the things that we were doing in the course, we're sort of trying to the idea, or I have a premise in my, teaching philosophy is we tend not to teach things or do things that we haven't experienced. And so, you know, it's interesting, the whole idea about teachers teaching about digital literacy and digital citizenship, but they may not have a digital footprint,
right?
Which I find interesting. So one of my learning intentions was, like, we need to create a digital footprint. And we did that in two ways. One way is creating an education e-portfolio, so really documenting their learning as teacher candidates and who they will be as teachers.
Awesome.
When they exit our program, which is super exciting because some of the work that they've done is incredible. And, you know, one of the things we talk about in teacher education is, who are you as a teacher? Like, you teach who you are. So who is that? And so it's really a delve into self and who you are or who you will be as a practitioner. So that's challenging work. The other way we're doing it, and I asked them, and you can't force people to do this, but I've asked if they would open a Twitter account and try to create a PLN. If minimum expectation was open up an account, see what's out there, be a lurker. There's different phases of, Twitter engagement, you know, being a lurker, you know, to being a participant, to being a contributor. And so, I wanted them to try it out. I got them, as you mentioned earlier, I'm one of the BC Ed Chat moderators or co-moderators. And so, I thought that would have been a safe place for them to try it out. So I would say all my candidates in that class had tried that out. And some had stayed, and some had, I just try it out once. You just got to try it, right? And they did. And so for me, how I'm sort of endorsing the idea of building your PLN and building a digital footprint, like I said, I was a little surprised how, ratio-wise, how few were online. It was really tampering with some people's vulnerabilities. And I think that's what it's about in terms of what is social media and our responsibilities online. And right now, there are people, I would say about a third who are active, and I was really grateful because they were just out on practicum. So to see exemplars that met FOIPA requirements, that, you know, all the learning intentions that came from our course, they were doing it as professionals, which was exciting. It's so good. And people who have chosen to be active on Twitter have met so many people. So I know one of my teacher candidates, was kind of fun in our program because we're smaller. We like to sort of try to really cater to the learner. And so she's an English language arts secondary teacher, and she had an opportunity to teach band.
Mm. Wow.
And she's a musician too, but not university credit, but she has all her levels in piano, teaches piano, et cetera. And she wanted to teach band and that was part of her interest. And so we wanted to accommodate that, how about a block of band? Right. And, anyway, long story short, you know what she did? She reached out to Twitterverse.
Yeah.
To connect to Music Ed, I think, Music Ed. And hashtag Music Ed, and she got a lot of great ideas. And so I just think that it's those little steps, they have to sort of at some level figure it out for themselves too. And my job is to open that door, to give them that opportunity. And so, what's kind of cool though is because our B-Ed program is 2 years. So that's the second year is engaging in the ed tech course. And so what happened is that a lot of our first years are hearing the work that our second years are doing. And so guess what? They've opened up their own Twitter accounts.
Awesome.
They're sharing their learning that's happening in classrooms. They're talking about being excited about going into their first practicum. And so to me, I just think, wow, that's not even, they're doing it because it's not about being, something you have to do for a course. Is actually something we just do because it's part of our culture. So that's what I hope that as we move along into our new program, that we can create that culture of engagement and connectedness.
I am just applauding over here, Christine. That is music to my ears. And I feel for some of those teachers who drop into Twitter and maybe, quote, give it a try for a while, and then they maybe fade off when they're not getting a whole lot of engagement. And I just want to give a few tips, like, you've got to, it's a social platform, so you have to engage with other people. If you're, you know, if you're following 10 people and you try a few solo shots, a few comments without tagging anyone and you don't get a response, you've got to engage. You've got to, you know, connect and reply and get involved in discussions. And so I think getting involved in BC Ed chat is so good. I mean, and we should say here, I mean, we've talked all about Twitter. I think of another educator, Shannon Schinkel, who I think is in
Prince
your neck
George.
Of the
woods.
She's doing amazing things on Facebook, and Facebook groups have been exploding as well. But yeah, I'm with you on Twitter. That's really my my sweet spot.
Yeah, and Shannon's an incredible blogger too. And so I say kudos to her. And really, you know, I'm standing beside her as she's doing that, right? You know, sometimes you just need someone there. And so she has a passion, really out there on Facebook for good reasons, and really, really sharing and collaborating online. So it's really amazing work that she's doing, for sure.
Awesome. I always go back to George Kouros, who says, how are you making learning go viral? And I might not be getting that perfect, but the idea there is, you know, you've got these amazing ideas and things that you're doing within your own four walls. How are you sharing that beyond your classroom and beyond your building? And that's so important. And man, once you really get a taste of, as you said, that one teacher, she just reached out to the Music Ed PLN, and here come all these ideas and encouragement. It's incredible. So we're on the same page there. Now, speaking of your PLN, Christine, as you look across your PLN and your own professional practice, what else is setting you on fire about education today? We've talked a lot about assessment. Where else are you looking these days?
You know, this is a really great question. My answer was weaving. My answer is weaving. And it sounds such the weirdest thing to talk about weaving. You know, and honestly, it was just about a year and a couple of years. Just talk about how do you make your thoughts and your sharing viral, you know, the learning viral. I mean, it is about being the learner. And so to me, a couple of years ago, I was so intrigued by cedar. And so now it's taking on this whole idea of weaving and cedar weaving, weaving with wool, weaving, beading. And so right now that's where my headspace is. I am really into the idea of embedding culture, and particularly BC local Indigenous culture, with mathematics. So I'm interested in that. And so I'm definitely another Prince George person. So this is doing beaded tweets. So I'm following Noelle Pepin, and she's wrote her master's project on beaded tweets. So it's connecting ADST and coding and Indigenous beading all in one, which I think is interesting. It's like bringing the two worlds together.
Amazing.
I think it's fascinating. And I just love, you know, there's lots of people, and Janice Novakowski from Richmond School District. And I know that she's involved with MOA, Museum of Anthropology at UBC, and she does weaving courses there. I just love that. And I love working with natural materials and how do they make patterns, and being kinesthetic and experiential with mathematics and numeracy. I'm excited about that. So I in the end, ultimately, is what is beaded tweets? What's culture in mathematics? What is numeracy across the curriculum? I mean, I'm just teaching a course right now with my secondary teacher candidates, and what does that look like? What is numeracy in English language arts? What is numeracy in drama? What is numeracy in, you know, in I would say even in mathematics? Right. You know, and so I just, that's where my headspace is. So it's divergent, apparently, as I'm talking out loud, but it's sort of just one thing leads to another thing. And I just, the idea of integrating First Peoples culture and mathematics in different ways that, I would say non-traditional in the Western mindset. But really I have a core belief that everyone can do math. We just have different entry points. And so what is that?
At my school right now, we're really trying to focus on the terms numeracy and literacy, as you were just saying, because, you know, when we use the term math, sometimes we make the mistake, and it's our mistake. It's not the word's fault. But I think sometimes we make this sort of paradigm error of sort of just pigeonholing math, right? Instead of seeing numeracy as applicable across so many different disciplines, as you were just saying. So that's fascinating. And I love the indigenous connections as well. I want to give a quick shout out to Denise Augustine, back to my master's program at VIU, who led us through some weaving there. And I have to say, I'm still developing. I'm not proficient yet, but in my weaving skills. Dr. Christine, we talked about your diverse resume. How are you looking to grow professionally and improve your practice throughout this year? Can you share with us about a specific professional goal or maybe another project that you are currently working on?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when I read that question and I was really brought to your one of your podcasts and tweet, and, you know, like you've mentioned that your word, one word, 2020 is right.
Yes.
And which I think is incredible. And then you set this very specific goal about publishing a book. I'm like, kudos to you. You know, and I say that because I just know that, you know, in the world that I'm in right now, you know, publishing takes a lot of courage and vulnerability. Writing a book, you know, and publishing and putting it out there to be seen, it takes a lot of courage and vulnerability. So I just say hats off to you. I am aspiring. And also the word right was my 2019 word. And it's been really interesting when we use one words as a means to focus. And I would like to say, put our lens on. What are we looking through? What lens are we looking through? And it focuses our behaviors to move towards a direction. And, you know, I've used one word also with my teacher candidates as they move into their long practicum coming up in a couple weeks. And so, you know, I did a lot of writing in 2019. So I don't think the word failed me in any way, but it wasn't the writing that I was looking for.
Mm.
Meaning that I was certainly doing some curriculum writing, which is great. Certainly doing some writing for others, which is great. But I really wanted to spend time writing to publish and really understand and transition into this world of higher education from being a teacher practitioner in K-12. So my one word in 2020 is tenure.
Mm.
It's not to say that I'm tenure track at this point in time, because I'm not. I would love to be. Or tenure, and nor can you be tenure within a year. So that's sort of, I don't want it to make that word misleading, but certainly it's, as I picked the word tenure as a mindset, you know, what does it mean to research? What does it mean to publish? What does it mean to connect and collaborate? What does it mean to discover new ideas? And I know that, you know, I did that, you know, certainly you do that through your dissertation work and thesis work, but it takes a different momentum when it's actually part of your job.
Right.
So I would love to sort of overcome my imposter syndrome and embrace, you know, Brené Brown's, you know, get past the whole shame mindset of who do you think you are, and just get over that.
Right.
And then, just get over myself and really be mindful and take the time to write and publish. And I say publish in the academic world. It could be in professional magazines, and maybe a book, because I have been wanting to write a book about my mom, who had passed away a couple years ago, and I would love to write a tribute to her in some way. So definitely I am aligned to your one word 2020 of right, and would like to take that further. That's connected to my professional goals.
Beautifully put. And tenure is a new one. Haven't heard that one around. So I love that you're thinking a little outside of the box, although certainly that's applicable to your context. That's a great word. I want to say one thing about my one word of right, and I'm so glad to hear it served you well last year, Christine. One qualification I must make is that I set aside this year as my writing and really my blogging year. And so what I've said is that if that goes well for this year, it's like my test case, then the book will be next year. So, I understand.
I'm sorry. That might be 2021.
I just don't want someone out there to call. Someone's going to call me out on Twitter in December of this year and say, "Hey, where's the book?" So this year.
Yeah. Well, and you're blogging and vlogging, which I think is pretty exciting.
Well, it's ambitious. I mean, we'll see where I am by March, but yeah, week two. So far, it's been fun. So thanks for for paying attention. I love the support. That's great. Christine, outside of education, what is another area of learning for you? Let's pull back the curtains on who you are as a human being. Talk to me about what ignites your passions when you leave the campus and what brings you alive.
Well, first of all, I really wanted to weave. So yeah. So I'll just put that out there. One of my students works at the Twin Rivers Art Gallery in Prince George. And on every Thursday night, they have makerspace workshops.
Oh, cool.
And I know. I mean, and it's funny when you live in a new town. It's kind of like you see things with different eyes, right? And so it's just, long story short, there's a weaver as one of the, in-house experts. And I'm like, okay, tell me more. So as I'm on this, cedar weaving, I can do other kinds of weaving, and I'm just sort of, and the reason why I say it's a learning for me personally, like professionally, yes, about numeracy and patterns and culture and what is this and really trying to sense make experientially. But personally, it's funny, when we think about ourselves as learners, I'm quite drawn to doing things I can't do. Mm-hmm. And I will say, you heard me, I'm a math teacher. I would say for most of my life, I didn't think I could read or write well. And it took a long time to sort of, I wouldn't say master it, right? But I have definitely a different confidence with it. And then, as you heard with my 2020 word, I want to take it another step further and have another kind of confidence with it. So the weaving for me, I just never thought I was good with the fine motor skills. Like me and textiles 9 was not copacetic at all. And so I just think it's just an interesting challenge to self. So I did take one of the workshops there through Beaded Tweets with Noelle Pepin. And I will tell you, I'm one of those learners that needed time and patience. That's the first people's principles of learning.
Yeah.
Learning takes time and patience. I understood that deeply during that workshop. That's one part. It sort of springboards off of my professional, but certainly I have a personal interest in weaving. The other part is it is so fascinating. I was at this event and it's just faculty. So it's in my mind, and it's funny because we create these images in our mind. Oh, these are professors, right? And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, these professors are professoring or whatever. I have no idea. So this is just me entering into this new work paradigm, right? And at this event, and it was really to my surprise, 5 professors, they practice and play in a band every week.
Fun.
Oh my gosh, it just blew my mind. I'm watching these guys and I'm like, I am really enjoying this. And it's not, I don't know if I recognized any of the songs. I'm just going to put that out there. But I just, what I was really enjoying was that it was intrinsically satisfying for them. So I thought, wow, this is something that they just do because it's enjoyable. And so one of the things I want to do, and the curling equipment should be in the mail. I just reordered some new curling equipment. So I used to curl as a kid.
Yay.
I used to curl competitively. I just want to tell you, I was a provincial champion.
Wow.
I know. Thank you. A little tidbit about myself. And that, and then sort of went to school and was on and off, moved, started work on and off, had my daughter on and off. And so really, I really enjoy the sport, but just never really carved out the time. To enjoy it again. So I made a commitment 2020, another part of my 2020 goals is ordered new equipment and I want to get on the ice because it seems like a Prince George thing to do, like a winter sport. And learn not just to learn how to play again, but there's a new twist on curling called doubles. And honestly, I don't know a lot about it, but all I know as doubles and furs is only 2 players versus 4. And it's a male-female team. And you play, I think, 6 ends. I want to say 8 ends. Honestly, I don't really know. But that's what I want to learn more about is to get back into the sport, re-immerse in it, and learn about how to curl doubles.
Okay.
I don't know if that made any sense to non-curlers. Non-curlers may not understand that, but...
I was thinking for our listeners from the South, we've got to explain curling in a sort of the 10-second version would be, think of a long ice rink and, you know, two teams are working to slide their rocks in as close to the center of a circle or concentric circles as possible. Is that fair?
You know what? No, you know what? You know that, that, you know, if you have no idea what curling is, that made no sense. You know what it is? It's curling really is shuffleboard on ice.
There we go. There we go. Everyone knows shuffleboard. Okay. Yeah. That was a horrible explanation. Okay. Shuffleboard on ice. So Christina, and that fits with tenure because you, that's part of the mission is to reestablish your tenure on the rink as former champion. You need to rule. Well, that is really, really cool. And yeah, that's something I don't think I've ever been out there on the ring. I don't think I've ever tried it. So my hat goes off to you there. That's fantastic. That was very fun. Well, Christine, we're about to get into your quick picks, but I do have one more question. What is your productivity regime? What does that look like? Do you have some habits or maybe an app or what is your style? How do you get it all done?
I have nothing to offer. I am like the worst. I have productivity habit or hack. Nothing. I have nothing. I'm one of those people who works under pressure, needs a deadline, will work all hours to reach that deadline. I wish I was one of those people who would pace themselves out even at all. And that's not how I'm sorry. I was just talking to a colleague and I labeled myself and she said, "You know those students?" I said, "Yeah, I do. I am those students." I am them. So there, I that's what I do. Just work under pressure.
Okay. So quick question here. Let's get a little bit serious because going back to formative assessment, moving away from traditional paradigms, some of the advocates for traditional paradigms would say students need that pressure of get it in by the deadline or marks off. So how do you respond to that?
You know, it's an interesting question that you asked that because for me, it's a deadline because the way I perceive it is everything is interdependent to what I'm doing. So if I don't submit something, then it has a domino effect.
Right. It's a social responsibility.
You're interconnected with others. And so it's kind of misleading with if I hand in an assignment or not. Does that actually have a real consequence? You know, and so a real consequence of losing marks, I guess for me would be what? I don't know. You know, like, I don't know. I can't think of an equivalent. If I didn't hand it in on time, then the work doesn't get done by others. And so I'm holding up other people. I don't know. So I feel like there's a social responsibility attached to meeting the deadline versus, I will say for a better word, pay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's a very literal, very extrinsic motivation, I suppose. But yeah, I think that's the right answer in the K-12 setting as well, because we have to remind our students, they have to see it as a learning community.
Yeah.
Right. And I think so they have a certain social obligation to others, don't they?
Yeah. And I think that's where I think about designing learning. And that's what I'm sort of tinkering with also in the teacher ed program in my classes is that there is no cheating. Mm-hmm. We're all in this together. We right. all want to meet the learning outcomes. We yeah. all want to work. We all want to, you know, get an A or whatever the case is. So it's not, I'm trying to do better than you. It's more like, hey, this is what I've learned. Did you learn this too? And so, you know, and if one person, you know, in quote, fails. I mean, it's in my mind, I think then we all failed.
Mm, so good.
Right. And so that's where I'm thinking about that.
Yeah, that's perfect. Christine, we're interested in hearing the education voices and resources that are shaping your practice and inspiring your thinking today. So let's start at Twitter. Tell us about someone we should follow there and share why they've been inspiring you lately.
This is like, I feel like this is like the hat trick, weaving, beating related. So back to Noelle Pepin, and she's also at beaded tweets underscore at, well, at beaded underscore tweets and at Noelle Pepin, same person. She, you know, just really quiet spoken, really humble, just really hasn't seen the power and potential that she has yet. And I think that she's just going to be definitely a person to follow. She's also a Prince George educator. She's Indigenous. She's really committed to her work here in the North. And I just feel aligned to her passion in terms of the storytelling that she wants to share with others. So I think that she'd be a great person to follow.
So cool. I'll make sure I'm following her. Point to an ed tech tool that you currently love using somewhere in your classroom or your professional practice.
Really, I wanted to say nothing. I find these questions really hard. But, you know, and then I say Office 365, but really I'm kind of using it just, I would honestly admittedly say PowerPoints. But, you know, I'll tell you, though, it was really fun this year, this term in my course. You know, we're talking about, let's journal in class. Let's, I'm playing around too, because I'm, you know, being a math educator and journaling in class and talking about our thinking and et cetera is I'm not new, but it's a practice that I haven't really adopted in a regular or routine way. And so we're doing that. And then it came up because they learned it from another class. Hey, we should do Google Docs. And basically they're doing their annotations of the chapter readings on one Google Doc, which is super fun. So we, you know, in course education, we have to make things kitschy. So we called it two quotes and a question. And so that, you know, pick two quotes that resonated with you and why, and a question that you have. And it's been really fun doing Google Docs. And I just know the potential of Office 365. So I love the idea of back to, and you can hear it actually ties into my philosophy about this interconnectedness, interrelatedness. We're co-creating this paper, co-constructing something. And I think Office 365 as a tool really can connect people that way and bring learning together. So I would like to learn more about that.
You've just given me an amazing idea for my own eighth grade practice, because I think about table groups sharing one Google Doc with a text and then annotating the same doc just in the manner that you described, two quotes and a question and some comments. I think that could be super powerful. Now, I did want to ask you earlier, what are your students using to build those online portfolios, those professional portfolios? Is it just sort of up to them?
I can only speak for my class. So this year, there's different platforms. And because we're a university, we have to be SPOIPA compliant as well. And so we're using WordPress. And, you know, at some level, WordPress, challenging. I get why people want to use other platforms because they're sort of user-friendly at first. I'll say it that way, user-friendly at first. WordPress can be, at some level, a little clunky. And I don't say that negatively, but once you start learning the tools and the potential that WordPress can do, it's really freaking amazing. And some of the stuff, like, this is what they call about, you know, back to our original conversation about, you know, grades and here's an expectation and, you know, single point rubric versus or whatever versus grade. I find grading, you know, they just go, what do I need to do to get a B? What do I need to do to get an A? What do I need to do to get a C? Like, you know, like that's what sometimes grading does, that, you know, they actually, you know, I guess at some level it's student choice in a way, but you know, like they're sort of fulfilling what they're just, you know, what they want to do or need to do. And I find, you know, when I was sort of putting that single point rubric mindset on, you know, the e-portfolios, and we're continuing on with the e-portfolio. So even though Education 431 has ended, now they're going into their long practicum, I want them to take their e-portfolios into practicum. The kind of work that the students were doing exceeded what I was able to do.
Cool.
Which, you know, isn't that what we want?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, and so the work that, like I say, that the candidates are doing and achieving is just phenomenal. And we're just at the beginning with them. So it's pretty fun.
So exciting. I think back to my guest, Julie Ross Kleinman, who said the goal should be the student surpasses the teacher, you know, and that's so exciting. Christine, we know you've read a ton of books, obviously, on your academic journey. Can you recommend one that maybe has been deeply influential in your practice or maybe one that you've been reading recently?
Yeah, I'm going to share my all-time favorite.
Yes.
Which is, you know, my go-to book, it's The Courage to Teach, Exploring the Inner Landscape of a Teacher's Life by Parker Palmer. I just bought his book on my Kindle, the 20th year edition. So it's not a recent book per se, but I just feel the first chapter is the heart of the teacher, identity and integrity. And if anyone wants a good read and really understand self as a practitioner, that to me is a winner. And I do use that for my intro courses in the teacher ed program. It does speak to who are we as we teach who we are. So we have to understand who we are, and people, our students can see that. That's in the end too, right? So it's about questioning self and who we want to be in front of our students. So I just really appreciate the honesty in this book, and it's one that I always go to.
So Rich, are you a podcast listener, Christine? If you are, tell us about one that you are enjoying these days.
Nah, I just became a recent podcast listener. Yay, guess which one I listen to. Oh, Teachers on Fire podcast.
Yes.
So I have to admit, I have not been a podcaster.
Sure.
Period, right? And I think, just connecting, this is why I think the power of Twitter and the PLN, back to that topic.
So good.
Honestly, we wouldn't have connected. You introduce yourself, it's even, and it's funny, even at the conference, I was kind of in a low. I was feeling low. I was feeling low. Yeah, because I was feeling low about what? Assessment and grades.
Right. Yeah, I remember that actually.
I was ending our term, and then it came down to grades. And I was just so sad. And I'm like, and you're like, oh, hi. I'm like, yeah, okay. Anyway, but that aside, so I appreciate the introduction. And I love that idea about Twitter and connection, and that we make connections not just online, but face-to-face. Like, I love the face-to-face reunion. Like, it's like a reunion. Like, it's people that you know, but you've never met, which is kind of strange in a lot of ways. After we met and you're podcasting, and just like you say, it's going on to Twitter, how you meet people online, you build a momentum with people in your community. So
absolutely.
So to know that your Teachers on Fire podcast, hearing your story that you shared with my students in class, was too compelling to not listen. So so really, honestly, I've enjoyed listening to your guests. I love the framework of your podcast. It's really enjoyable when I go for a walk or wake up on a Saturday morning and have a cup of coffee. So I've just been really enjoying it. Thank you. So that's what I listen to.
Well, I am blushing over here. Thank you for the high praise, Christine. And yeah, there are so many out there. It's an amazing landscape. And like you said, I mean, we build these online connections, and then when they become IRL, it's so awesome. And you are, I have to say, I was seeing your name on Twitter so often, when I saw your name on the conference list, I'm like, that's where I'm headed. I'm going to that workshop because I need to meet this person. And you are even more fun in real life than you are on Twitter, if that is possible. So that was a good choice. All right, Christine, the last two questions here have to do with video. First of all, on YouTube, and I'm quite aware that not everyone is a YouTube subscriber per se, but tell us about a channel that you're enjoying over there.
Oh my gosh. And here I'm such an honest person. I just say that because I'm like super, super embarrassed to say this, but because I watch Dr. Pimple Popper. It's like this little dirty secret that I have. And I know that she has a TV show, and it's heavily edited.
Okay.
So I just find that particular channel satisfying. But we don't have to talk about my favorite pots, etc. But that's what I watch.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well,
not education related, but could be. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. Could be. Maybe it's used somewhere in the medical field. And then most of us these days are on Netflix, although now we have, of course, Amazon and Disney Plus. But what are you watching right now? Is there a season or a series that you're into?
Yeah, it's funny because Netflix, I will say I'm one of those people who will binge, and not voluntarily. It just happens.
Yeah.
So I have to say I'm not watching Netflix at this point in time because I do need to work. but I really, really have enjoyed Schitt's Creek. And I'm so happy that it's on Netflix. So I definitely binge watched that, and I enjoy the storylines and the relationships that are built on that show between the family and friends. And honestly, so now I'm watching it via CBC, you know, once a week for half an hour, and it's like it's not quite the same because I kind of want to go on to the next episode, but you know, immediately. But it's a fun show. And the other thing, I just to keep things light for me, is the, you know, Seinfeld's comedians in cars getting coffee. So I find that hilarious.
Christine, we've covered so much ground. Some of it serious, some of it lighter today. For those interested in your message and looking to connect on Twitter and elsewhere, what are the best ways for people to reach out and follow you?
Definitely best to reach out to me on Twitter at ChristineYH. Definitely you can get some contact information from my blog website at ChristineYoungHusband.com. And I'm also on Instagram at ChristineHoYoungHusband.
Sounds good, Christine. Hey, I want to say it's been such a pleasure to finally connect with you at length. You are a phenomenal educator, but you're even more of a phenomenal human being. And I know that came across. I know my listeners are going to enjoy this one. So I want to say thank you so much for sharing your time with the podcast today. It's been a long time in coming, and it's been everything that I hope for and more. Take care, and let's talk again soon.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Before we sign off today, I'd like to share some highlights from around the Teachers on Fire community this week. First stop on Twitter, where Stephanie Edmonds at Class Disruption tweeted, "Started my week on fire with a podcast from at Teachers on Fire featuring at the Merrill's EDU, Kristen Merrill. She has an amazing story about blocking out the judgment and reservations to do what she believes in, and that's how you affect change. Hashtag be the change you want to see. Hashtag Monday Motivation." Thank you for that, Stephanie. You know you are one of my faves, and make sure you give at Class Disruption a follow here on Twitter and over on Instagram, where Stephanie lights up the IG stories on a daily basis. On LinkedIn, Kevin O'Shea wrote, "Check out this awesome education podcast. If you're in education, the Teachers on Fire podcast should be in your library." Thank you for that as well, Kevin. Make sure you follow Kevin at MadForMaple on Twitter. He's doing some very cool things all the way from China and, of course, specializing these days in outdoor education. To all who have read, viewed, liked, retweeted, commented, or replied to my content on any of these platforms, thank you. Know that you are the fuel to my fire, and I so appreciate your support and encouragement. Make sure you drop by the Teachers on Fire magazine on Medium, where our writing team put out three pieces this week. Kelly Christofferson at Kelly W. Chris on Twitter wrote, "Innovation isn't always about something new." And that sort of resonates with something John Spencer's been talking a lot about lately, which is that vintage can still be innovative. I wrote a piece called "Model That Metacognition." And Dr. Deborah M. Vereen at Dr. D. M. Vereen published "Parents Deserve a High Five." And Dr. Deborah's specialty is really in this whole area of parent and family engagement. The Teachers on Fire magazine is a Medium publication, which you'll find on Medium.com or on the Medium app. If you're interested in education writing, consider joining us there. You can continue to publish content on your own blog, and you keep full credit and ownership of your content on Medium. Plus, the Medium platform compensates you based on the engagement and read time your articles earn. Message me at Teachers on Fire on any social media platform for more details. Did you know that I've started vlogging on YouTube? That's right, this is scary new territory for me, but it is happening. This week I published "Model That Metacognition," about three questions that can fuel lifetimes of learning. Your likes, comments, and subscriptions are a huge inspiration. I do notice everyone, so thank you for that support as well. I will leave you with this quote from my reading this week, Teachers on Fire. It comes from a book called Intention, Critical Creativity in the Classroom, which is authored by Dan Ryder at Wicked Decent on Twitter and Amy Burvall at I'm Amy Burval on Twitter, and the quote is simply this: perhaps the greatest calling of an educator is to inspire students to want to wonder and learn about things on their own. One more time, perhaps the greatest calling of an educator is to inspire students to want to wonder and learn about things on their own. Again, I am your host, Tim Cavey, and I'm so grateful that you decided to spend some of your day listening to this podcast. I hope that in some way the content you heard today from Dr. Christine Younghusband ignited your thinking and inspired your practice, and I'll meet you next week right here on the Teachers on Fire podcast. Take care and have a great week.